Blog Talk Radio.
Love or fear? Which path forward? That's the subject for tonight's discussion. Please stay with us. We'll be right back, and we hope you'll join us with your take on it. Our roots began in Africa, where we enjoyed self-determination and freedom, which were rooted in our sovereignty. Peace, family. Welcome to Dare to Win, the Us Lifting Us weekly radio program that airs every Thursday evening, p.m. Eastern Time. Dare to Win is the place where we have sobering conversations about the economic plight of Black people and the imperative that we build the global economic machinery that will free us and once again put us on the path of making history. We at Us Lifting Us have developed an exact methodology on how to build this global machinery and pass it forward to our children and future generations. If you'd like to join tonight's conversation, please call 929-477-2789. Press the number 1 on your phone when you want to make a comment or ask a question. If you prefer to listen on your computer, go to www.usliftingus.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the home page. Click on the Dare to Win button. Then click on Listen Live. You will then be on the Blog Talk Radio site. If you want to get reminders from Blog Talk Radio for upcoming Dare to Win programs, click on the Follow button. ULU members, we have our own social media community. please join if you have not already done so. There is a Dare to Win group, and we would like to have your feedback on past Dare to Win programs, as well as topic suggestions for future programs. I'm Sister Q, and joining me for this evening's discussion is Brother Antti, who, like me, is a member of Ulu. Peace, Brother Antti, how are you doing tonight?
Peace, Sister Q. I am well, and thank you for asking. Glad to be with you tonight and the family, and looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you for joining us. We're looking forward to your discussion as well. So to begin, Brother Antti, what makes you ask the question, love or fear, which way forward?
Thank you for that, Sister Q. And it's a strange question, perhaps, when we're an organization focused on economic liberation and economic self-determination. We have said time and time again that the work that we're doing in Ulu is not only building Black cooperative business enterprises and Black economic institutions, we really are building a Black economy, a global economy that is cooperative, family-centered, group-owned, African values-based, cooperative enterprise institution, scale of a multi-billion dollar mothership cooperative, as we like to say, and supported by hundreds of secondary cooperatives supplying all of our material needs, food, clothing, shelter, energy. So when we are talking to our sisters and brothers about building this global economic model, it occurs to us that oftentimes we as a community, because we have been submerged and deluged with the free enterprise rhetoric that is thrown around in this country, have not understood that all social systems are driven by the economic base upon which they rest. In other words, the economic base of all societies determines the character and the characteristics of that society. So we find ourselves in 2021, 2022, living in a world that is literally on fire as wildfires rage through California and the western United States. Fascism is galloping across the country at breakneck speed. People are scared to death of pandemics and runaway viruses. People are wringing their hands and praying somehow the country will return to normal. We fail to realize and don't want to accept that the chickens of capitalism are coming home to roost. So the United States has been doing all of this underhanded skullduggery in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, disrupting governments, assassinating leaders, controlling the politics, making it impossible for the average person to live a normal and decent life. And now that behavior that has been perpetrated against the rest of the world has come home to roost here in the United States. So we see this rise in gun violence. We see the confusion. We see the chaos. We see the effects of climate denial, so that no one has taken responsibility for changing the way we behave on the planet. And so now Mother Nature has stepped in, and we see global warming, and the entire human family and the planet is on the verge of climate collapse. That is what has been produced by the economic model of capitalism, and that is what we're wrestling with. Welcome to the new normal. America is again at an inflection point. We can chart a new future or cling desperately to a fading past. The 1% are stuck on stupid. The real question is, what will we black people do in this pregnant historical moment? And it is interesting, Sister Q, that we find ourselves in August, the month of the birth of Marcus Mosiah Garvey, born in 1887. Mm-hmm. And it is important to note that this country was at a similar point between the years of 1918 and 1929. Many listening mm-hmm. this evening will recall that that Marcus Garvey not only founded the UNIAACL, that is the Universal Negro Improvement Association, and the African Communities League in 1914, but that organization in 1919 formed the Black Star Shipping Line. Now, because Garvey had made the cry, Africa for the African at home and abroad, and he cast a vision of black people, whether they were on the continent of Africa, whether they were in the Caribbean, he being of being born in Jamaica, or whether they were in North America, he saw global trade taking place by and for and with black people. And so he proposed the Black Star Shipping Line. That vision ignited a fire in the hearts and the minds of black people around the globe. And they pooled their money. They bought these shares in the Black Star Shipping Line to capitalize this venture that would purchase shipping ships that could then start this commerce of global trade amongst black people on the planet. Now, what we have to keep in mind, Sister Q, is that it not only is 1919 such a critical year. Keeping the World War One has ended. It raged from 1914 to 1918. It truly was a world war. It brought millions of men into the theater of war, and hundreds of thousands of blacks were able to get into the military to prove their worth, to determine once and for all that they were worthy of citizenship in the United States. They went over to Europe to fight, distinguished themselves, received the highest military honors, and then returned back to the United States only to find that this country was still calling them the N-word. Some of them were even hung in their uniforms. So that the time period, 1919, 1920, 21, 23, 25, is a critical and crucial time period in American history. And black folks find ourselves caught up in the midst of a horrific backlash of white domestic terrorism against black communities.
For sure.
So in the summer, as a matter of fact, it is so severe that the summer of 1919 came to be called Red Summer, as more than three dozen cities erupted in white riots against black communities, and hundreds, thousands of people, black people, were killed in these riots. We remember the Tulsa massacre on May 31st of 1921. They officially 300 some odd blacks were killed, but most people who saw that, who lived during that, said that the toll was close. It was had to have run into the thousands, because there were people that never were accounted for. We know that the Rosewood community was assaulted in 1923. That entire community was burned to the ground. So so black people in America, on the continent, and throughout the diaspora, in the midst of this unmitigated and unhinged attack against us, have always rallied together, dug deep within ourselves to tap into our own agency and self-determination and build the economic structures and institutions that we need. And I'm trying to make us aware of how we as a people confront extreme conditions. In other words, we don't wilt and run away.
Right.
We stand firm, we stand strong, and we draw upon the internal resources that make us the very powerful and dynamic people that we are. And so the question that we're facing this evening, Sister Q, is this mm-hmm. question of what kind of society do we want to build for ourselves and our children? Do we want it to be characterized by love, or will we succumb to and fall into the general fear that is gripping the nation that is evidenced by the madness of January 6th, and now that Mar-a-Lago has been raided and folks are losing their minds. Again, these are the precursors for another wave of white domestic terrorism aimed at black communities. So this is not a rhetorical question about the path that we choose to go forward. But mm-hmm. before we can talk about setting up businesses and setting up cooperatives, we have to take a step back and say, okay, do we want to live in fear? Do we want to be looking over our shoulder? Do we want to have to be armed to the teeth every time we move about? Are we going to be foaming at the mouth and raging at other communities? Is that the kind of world that we want for our children? And if we want something different and something better, then the place to begin is to say, okay, let's restructure the economic base of our community so that what we build on top of that economic base will in fact be sustainable and will create a climate of calm and peace and love and justice for everybody. But it certainly will be a cocoon, a bubble in which we can live and thrive and sustain ourselves going forward. So the point that I want to make, Sister Q, is that if we say that we want that kind of loving environment for our children, it mm-hmm. requires a different economic system than the one that we are living in. That's the point that I want to get to first and foremost tonight. If we want a society characterized by love and peace, then we must have a cooperative economic model. And when we say that in Ulu, what we mean is we are organizing our behavior to build an Ujamaa economy, family-centered, group-owned, African values-based, cooperative business institution. All of those components are necessary if we're going to break out of the madness that we find ourselves in and chart a new course for ourselves and the rest of the human family, quite frankly. Let me pause there. There may be some questions, or you may have wanted to make a comment, Sister Q.
There are no hands raised on the board right now. I guess what I would like for you to talk about just a little bit more in detail is what would a fear-based economic system look like other than capitalism, or how do you picture the love-based economic system? What would be the underlying tenets of it, you know?
Okay, that's an excellent question. And the point that I want our listeners to hear tonight is that the economy determines the society. It's not the society mm-hmm. determines the economy. It is the economy first that shapes and colors and determines how the society will operate. The other thing I was thinking about, and I just want to throw this out and kind of get your reaction and the reaction of those listening to the call, is
mm-hmm.
that, you know, oftentimes when we're in, you know, conversations and the economy is being discussed, it sounds very technical. It almost sounds like rocket science. But an economy, all it really is an arrangement of economic behavior by people. In other words, a group of people decide that they're going to handle their money and their behavior in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference between a private-based economy and a group-owned economy, whether the economy is privately owned or whether it's group-owned. Whether it's about exploitation and oppression and domination, or whether it's about sharing and cooperation and taking care of the environment. So that when we think of capitalism, and thank you for asking that question, we had said in a previous broadcast, going back a couple of months now, if you do a study of the word capitalism, in other words, you look at the etymology of the word capitalism,
mm-hmm.
the root word of capitalism is a word called caput, C-A-P-U-T, and it means
okay.
head, like head
okay.
of cattle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, the root word of the word chattel is also kaput. So in
okay.
other words, the root word of capitalism is kaput, and the root word of chattel is kaput.
Mm-hmm.
And when you break it down, all chattel is private property that is mobile.
Mm-hmm.
In other words,
mm-hmm.
private property that is mobile. And so what happened to African people in this encounter with these European invaders onto the continent going back to the 1400s? In the process of them exploiting us, not only did they shackle us and pack us like sardines into the holds of these ships and drag us over to North America, they also catalyzed us. That is, they reduced us, African women and men, they reduced us to chattel, where we became private property, bereft of any rights and values as human beings that white people had to respect. That is so profound a transformation that one writer that we have read and talked about on these airwaves before, Ezra Aharon, has said that what we enjoy as freedom in this country, even today, he calls it chattel freedom. In other words, we have not shed the label and the characteristics of having been viewed as chattel for 300 plus years.
Mm.
We do not understand that, so that when Derek Chauvin puts his knee on the neck of George Floyd for 9 minutes, it's because in his mind, George Floyd was chattel. He's property.
Mm-hmm.
He's the private possession mm-hmm. of this dominant community. Now, in our mind, we're thinking, well, this is the worst, this is the most horrific thing you could do to another human being. But in the
mm-hmm.
In a system where we are viewed as chattel, then anything that the owners of this chattel decide to do to us is okay. It is sanctioned by law. If they decide to rape
mm-hmm.
us, it's okay. If they breed us like cattle, it's okay. If they maim us because we ran away and tried to escape, it's okay. If they kill us, it's okay. We are chattel. And so that is the prison that we find ourselves operating in in this capitalist system. The only way to break that, and we are the only ones that can break that, we have to break out of the definition of us as chattel and declare ourselves human, declare ourselves divine beings, divine women and men. And therefore, we must create an alternative economic model that affirms our worth and value as beings created in the image and the likeness of this divine energy. In other words, what we're trying to argue tonight, Sister Q, is that if we are going to exist on this planet as human beings and bring to ourselves all the rights and privileges as humans, then we must create the economic system that also affirms that we are human and not chattel. And so that's why the question, love or fear. If we love ourselves, then we'll realize that we have to get busy and create this structure that treats us as human and divine. We cannot leave our definition in the hands of others who have already told us that in their eyes we're chattel. That's their view. And
exactly.
If that's what they want to operate on, then that's what they operate on. If we disagree with that, then it's up to us to create an economic system that allows us a different self-definition. In other words, we have to exercise our own Kuji Chagalir, our own agency, and when we come forward with what we are calling this Ujamaa economy that says that, first of all, this is a group-owned business enterprise. It's family-centered. It's based on the African values of Ma'at, truth, justice, righteousness, order, harmony, balance, and reciprocity. When we establish that mechanism, then and only then can we transcend the crippling definition of ourselves as chattel. And let's be very clear. If the very people who have oppressed us for 400 years then turn around and say, okay, y'all are free, y'all are good folks now, that still has not that still has not resolved the issue of us being chattel. Only we can break that definition. And that is why we labor diligently to make the case of building this Ujamaa economy. Now, the reason I get excited about looking at what Marcus Garvey and the UNIA did in 1918 through the 1920s is without cell phones, without TikTok and social media, without the internet, Garvey managed to organize 6 million black folks on the continent, in the Caribbean, in North America, in Europe, the largest organization of black folks ever put together on the planet. And when they came forward to say we're setting up the Black Star Steamship Line, he was also saying we take it upon ourselves to create our own economic model. Now, if he can do that in the midst of white terrorism, And domestic terrorism against the black family worldwide, certainly we can do that again in 2022. And we must do that again in 2022. Now, the exciting thing is that us lifting us in establishing ourselves as an economic development cooperative LLC, we've created the shell organization to hold the resources that we need to set up these cooperative enterprises. In other words, the legal work is done. What we are doing in these weekly Dare to Win broadcasts is hammering away at the psychological work of we don't have to have people's permission to pool our money.
Mm-hmm.
All we have to do is pool our money. We've
mm-hmm.
got black banks that can hold the money. We know that we don't want to set up privately owned competitive business models. In other words, we don't want to duplicate capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we say Ujamaa economy, we're talking about creating these group-owned, family-centered, African values-based, cooperative business enterprises. It's all on us. Don't have to wait for anybody. Don't have to ask anybody. It's all on us. And what we're finding, Sister Q, is that when we say pool our resources, and that's what Marcus Garvey did with the Black Star Steamship Line. They sold shares for $5 a pop. And $5 in 1918, 1919 was serious money. I'm not making small
sure.
of that.
Sure.
And so what we're saying is that in order for us to open this network of cooperative business enterprises, we're going to need capital. We're going to
mm-hmm.
need money to set up these businesses. And where we get that money is each person that's a member of Us Lifting Us agrees to purchase a co-op unit for $1,000. Now, some people got it in their pocket. They can pull it out and do it tonight. Right. We know this. Others will take
mm-hmm.
a little more time. But we have a $25 per month subscription plan. And so if they just put away $25 a month, they can get to a place where they can purchase a co-op unit in about 3 years. And you know how
mm-hmm.
we do. We can definitely do it in quicker than that. But even
right.
even if it takes the entire time, we're still talking about 3 years and maybe 3 or 4 months to get to $1,000 to purchase that co-op unit. Then when we have,
right.
for every 1,000 members who purchase a co-op unit of $1,000, that's $1 million, right? So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was looking at some of the math of it. You know, if you figure we're 40 million in this country and we've got $1.3 trillion flowing through our hands every year, a small percentage of that would give us a multi-billion dollar budget to work from every year. The other thing is, after this initial pooling of money to open the businesses, as the businesses become mature and generate a surplus, then it's not necessary to continue to prime the pump. The businesses at that point
right.
are strong enough to grow on their own and provide the economic sustenance that our community needs. All we're doing is priming the pump and starting the cycle. We're beginning the critical mass so that we can have the chain reaction that will run into perpetuity. So it's doable. It's just a question of whether or not we are convinced that this is within our means and it most certainly is. Let me pause there. I've said a lot. There may be some comments or some questions.
I don't see any hands up right now. What I did while you were talking is go to the economic calculator
mm-hmm.
online, and it says that the equivalent of $5 in 1919, it says,
mm-hmm.
one of them it says is $139.40 today. And another one
mm-hmm.
says it's $84.49 today. So we are about equal, you know, because
yeah.
we're asking for $50, that may be like $10. So
yep.
in that day. So it's not like we are being overly greedy, I guess you could. Yeah, I mean, you know, like we're not taking in consideration that
right.
the value, what else you could be doing.
right.
with your $50
right.
or whatever, you know. So
yep.
Before people start saying, oh, well, all Garvey asked for was $5. Why do we have to give so much? You know, it's not like that at all. You're not.
Right.
And even if it was,
thing,
if you got it like that, go ahead.
That's right, if you got it like that. And the thing is that as a member in this economic enterprise called Us Lifting Us, every person has a vote. And that's mm-hmm. the beauty of the cooperative structure. In the capitalist structure, each share is a vote. So if mm-hmm. I'm a share owner in Corporation X, and I own mm-hmm. 1,000 shares, when we get to the annual meeting and policy is being discussed, and it's time to vote, I'm voting those 1,000 shares. Now, if someone else has 10,000 shares, they have more clout in the corporation than I do. But if mm-hmm. someone has fewer shares, then I have more clout than them. In
right.
a cooperative structure, each person has one vote, regardless of the number of co-op units that you own.
Mm-hmm.
You see how that levels the playing field?
For
so
sure.
In other words, there are no big I's and little U's. Every person stands toe-to-toe, eye-to-eye, and says, I think this is the way we should go. And
mm-hmm.
and so that's a far more democratic process than, you know, I'm in the room with the other shareholders. It's 100 shareholders in the room. They may own a couple of thousand shares, and I own 10,000 shares. So whatever I say is what happens. The
right.
voice doesn't even matter. Because I own
mm-hmm.
51% of the stock, I call all the shots.
Exactly.
That's what happened.
Good. That happened with Facebook, I don't know, 3-5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The shareholders were very dissatisfied with Zuckerberg, and they wanted to vote him out as CEO or whatever he is of Facebook, and everybody voted to put him out, but he had 59% of the shares.
Right.
So he's,
right. So
he's
one
still
person,
there.
Right. One
yeah.
person stares down the entire membership.
Yeah. And it's like
so,
thousands of people that own Facebook shares. So, like you say, it's thousands of people to one, and that one person with 59% of the shares negates all those thousands of people.
Right, right. So, you know, I had a chance to go to Accra, Ghana this past summer, but we're still in summer,
mm-hmm.
In June. And I went to... and I'm sure people that have gone to Ghana have been to there. I went to the Elmina slave dungeon, which
mm-hmm.
was built by the Portuguese back in 1484. Now, the Portuguese
okay.
were the dominant colonial power in Ghana for, I think, 85 years. And then after they were replaced by the Dutch, which were there for like another 230 years, and then they were followed by the British. Dungeon, just to show you how warped and how demented the European mindset is when it comes to African people, those dungeons, the holding rooms might have held a couple of hundred people. The ventilation wasn't
mm-hmm.
the greatest. Think of this. You're in there for weeks or months at a time waiting for the ships to come in to carry people to North America. You also have
mm-hmm.
to wait for the tides and the winds to make it right to make the journey. So you might be in this dungeon for 6 or 8 weeks or longer. There are no
mm-hmm.
restrooms in the holding cell. So
right.
they would just designate mm-hmm. a corner where people would have to relieve themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you've ever been in a restroom where the toilet's backed up, you know the stench alone will put a hurting on you. Can you imagine being confined in a room, a couple of hundred people, where there is no toilet for people to relieve themselves? And there's a chute in the ceiling where these Europeans would drop food down into the holding cell for the enslaved people to eat. I mean, it was just unimaginable that people had to endure this. This is part of the process of the chattelization of our people, complete dehumanization. And that says something about the kind of economic model that you're operating. In other words, in their economic model, the only people who have value are the people who have lots of money, the 1%. Everybody else is just a peon or pauper. And so that's why we have to not jump into an economic system that's already in place that they have created, because those values are embedded in every transaction. Every time the register goes ka-ching, those values are being reinforced: the dehumanization, the exploitation, the extraction, the oppression, the violence. All of that is sanctioned every time the register rings up a sale. And so understanding that, we then now have to think in terms of, okay, how do we put together an economy that reverses all of that? And so let me share this definition of love. There's a book called Ma'at, The 11 Laws of God, written by Rao Nefer Amen, and he provides this very clear and simple definition. And I'm going to give the definition and just contrast this definition to what you and I have seen living and trying to survive in America. Rao Nefer's definition of love is this: love is giving, seeking nothing in return. Well, every time I read that, I just have to pause and let that marinate for a minute. Love is giving, seeking nothing in return. Keep in mind, when we talk about an Ujamaa economy, we're talking about a family-centered economic enterprise. In family, we don't look at our sisters and brothers and see dollar signs. We see our sisters and brothers, and what we're trying to do is create a space where all of us can live our best life, where we can grow and be the very best version of ourselves, right? We're not trying to make profit off of each other. We recognize that we all have gifts, and so we want those gifts to be shared in this space that we call the family.
Right.
It's a very different energy in terms of how we think about the business of providing for our food, clothing, and shelter, and our material needs. You see the difference? I mean, it even feels different. So love is giving, seeking nothing in return. And please note that this definition isn't an emotion. Most times when people say, "I love you," or "I sure love that," or whatever, they're coming out of an emotional construct. This definition of love is not an emotional construct first. It is an intentional and deliberate expression of selfless behavior. Now, when one lives their life in alignment with cosmic law and finds themselves in perfect harmony and unity with the world, the feeling that accompanies this state of being is often referred to or called love. In other words, when we live in this kind of harmonious interaction with each other, and because we are in balance and because there's reciprocity, that feeling that comes out of that, that's what people call love. But the basis of this love is this decision that I'm going to give you the very best of me, not seeking anything in return, but just because it's in me to do that. Now, what happens when everybody is doing that, it results in a community of tremendous abundance because nobody's lacking. Everybody is doing their dead level best, giving their all, and so there's just this abundance and this surplus, and there's more than any one person could ever carry off by him or herself.
For sure.
That's a very different kind of way of being in the world. And we need an economic model that can help us do that. So the feeling aspect of this condition is the secondary aspect of love. What is most important, though, is the idea of giving of oneself, seeking nothing in return. So now, on the other hand, fear is this, and people have different definitions. I find this one helpful. False education accepted as real. We know it as that feeling one gets when they experience a sense of profound danger. Their blood pressure elevates. Their arteries constrict. Their heart pounds. Their body temperature goes up as they prepare to fight or fight. So that's how you and I find ourselves living in America. We don't realize it, but, you know, they talk about black people are tend to be exhibit hypertension. Well, yeah, if every time you stepped out the house, you had to worry about somebody rolling up on you, calling you the N-word and taking shots at you, your blood pressure might stay elevated too, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
So
for sure.
The fact that we live in a hostile environment has had a tremendous negative impact on our health outcomes, and we know this. And so for us, that is another reason why it is an absolute imperative that we build this cooperative economic model, because it produces a society that is calm and caring, compassionate, sustainable, and just. And I need to say a word simply about that sustainable aspect, Sister Q. This capitalism has been, you know, chugging along for the last couple of hundred years, especially after the discovery of oil, and everything was switched over to this fossil fuel based economy. So the electricity is dependent upon fossil fuels. The cars are dependent on fossil fuels. The trucks. The heating of our houses is dependent upon fossil fuels. And so much research has gone into oil compounds, et cetera, that that now drives the fertilizer industry. That bleeds into the pharmaceutical industry. So the entire social apparatus is tied into fossil fuels. And as we continue to extract and burn these fossil fuels and put that CO2 into the atmosphere, that's what's driving global warming. Now, they know this, and they've known it since the late 60s at least, but rather than find an alternative source of energy, either solar or wind or hydro or whatever, because their profits are tied to this, they refuse to change their behavior. And so even in the face of calamitous weather, wildfires, floods, droughts, violent storms, I mean, it's slapping everybody in the face that something very different is going on with the weather, and we have to change. But because that's their money, they refuse to alter their behavior. So if we don't do anything, the system is going to collapse regardless, because it is crumbling under the weight of its own internal contradictions. But we must act, because we are called to act, and that kind of failure is simply not an option. I know the ancestors didn't go through all that they went through to put us to a place where we could make a difference, and then for mm-hmm. us to renege on our responsibility and just allow the system to collapse. That is not a good look for us.
Right.
And so,
you know, Brother Auntie, you were talking about an economy based on fear, and you speak of the petroleum-based economy that the U.S. has,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
then
yes.
it's fear throughout everything, because if everything is made of petroleum and petroleum might give out, then I have a fear that there's not enough. So it won't
right.
be enough petroleum to run my car. I won't have enough
mm-hmm.
petroleum for heat. I won't be able to grow food. Everything is a fear that, as you said, gets
right.
into the marrow of the people and causes disease conditions. So
mm-hmm.
that's, I think, something else we need to look at when considering the economic conditions we find ourselves in. We have
Absolutely.
A caller, Brother Auntie. So I'm going
okay.
to take this raised hand. Peace, caller with the last four digits 3440. Please state your name, where you're calling from, and make your comment or ask your question. Thank you.
Greetings, family. Sister Q, Brother Auntie, this is Brother Shibaka. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Brother.
Very well.
Yeah, I was experiencing some problems a couple of weeks ago. But anyway, good talk, Brother. And I wanted the collapse angle, I want you to elaborate a little bit on, because I share your views that I see some things falling apart, you know. And I keep reminding myself of a conversation I heard. This guy, Klaus Schwab, who is the CEO of the World Economic Forum, talks about that, you know, in 10 years or by 2030, you'll own nothing and be happy. And so that's his assessment based on his examination. How much time do you think we got?
Well, that's an interesting question, Brother Shibaka. And it varies, I guess, depending on which particular expert is sharing their thoughts. I saw where the United Nations panel on climate change has said that we need to cut fossil fuel emissions by 50% by 2030, or we're going to risk irreversible climate outcomes. Others say, you know, we got till 2035, maybe 2050. I'm thinking it's probably sooner than later. So, but what I'm also believing, Brother Shibaka, is that if, first of all, I'm of the opinion that nature doesn't like a vacuum. And so as this system collapses, now is the ideal time for us to be putting in place our system that will sustain us and sustain people who want a just and righteous future. The idea, first of all, cooperatives are not new. And Africans have had various iterations of communal economic models, which is really at the heart of the cooperative movements that are prevalent in today's world. So this really is a Sankofa moment for us. In other words, we're going back to bring forward the best of African economic practices. And applying those values and those processes in the context of 2022 and the years ahead. And for me, I think what's most important, A, is the idea of this is a group-owned enterprise. We can't get away from that. This is not private ownership of the means of production. This is group ownership of the means of production, the factories, the technology, the computers, the robots. It's group-owned. And it's family-centered. That's the African piece for us. This idea that Nayeti worked so hard to communicate to us, this idea of Ujamaa, familyhood, that, in other words, it's the love of family that guides us in terms of how do we do business with each other. See, we come into the economic conversation with a whole preset notion of what economics is. So we're looking for return on investment. We're looking for how much profit is this going to generate. And all of that, those are the wrong kinds of questions. And the wrong energy. For example, there's a paper on the website that talks about this African economy, and it says, first of all, land in the African sense could not be owned or sold. It was a gift from the Creator, and it had to be used. And so it was the village or the clan that distributed the land so that everyone had access to land that they could farm, where they could build their house and create the village, whatever the activities that needed to be. That's a very profound shift in how we think about economics. You mean to say I can't buy this piece of land and put a fence around it and tell everybody else no trespassing? No, fool. You know, you didn't have the only reason you can claim that parcel of land is because you have a gun to shoot everybody that they try to take it from you. There's no inherent claim that you have to some land, especially when we consider the fact that, you know, Europeans rolled up on North America and said, oh, we discovered North America. And, you know, meanwhile, the indigenous folk were sitting here looking at them like, how are you going to discover this and we already here? So the root of this economic confusion is that they have crafted an economic model based on theft and greed and violence and extraction for the 1%. And that's what we find ourselves doing battle against. Let me say this before time gets completely away. Years ago, I heard a prophetic minister say, where we are going does not yet appear. We will have to build it when we come to the right place. I didn't understand it then, but he was talking about a place of cooperative consciousness. And so thank you, Brother Chibaka, for your question, because that's what we are pushing ourselves to get to, this place of a cooperative mindset, a cooperative consciousness that begins to look at each other as these valuable beings and who have these gifts and this intrinsic genius that we want to share with each other. And so how do we structure that in an economic model that does not violate our divinity and our humanity? So these are some kind of profound questions that we have to wrestle with. The good news is that Us Lifting Us Economic Development Cooperative, Dare to Win program, is the place where we can have these conversations, hammer out these structures, and put together these cooperative business enterprises that we own collectively and that will provide our food, our clothing, our shelter, our energy. And just like Garvey and his 6 million members in the UNA, they built a global organization to meet the needs. That's our work. Hey, pool our dollars, open cooperative business, use the surplus of those businesses to operate African-centered schools, hospitals, elder care centers, and return a dividend to the member owners. Sister Q, thank you. Thank you for your time and letting us get this out tonight. Thank you, Brother Shabaka, and all those who were on the call.
Thank you, Brother Shabaka, for your question and statement. Thank you, Brother Angti, for tonight's discussion and the demonstration between what a fear-based economic system looks like and what a love-based economic system would look like. And so we should be clear by now that we are in a fear-based system, and if we don't like it, then we need to change our way of thinking so that we can create a love-based economic system.
Exactly.
Thank you again. Thank you, Brother Shabaka, for your statement, your comment. And we want to thank everyone who joined us this evening. We invite you to join us again next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock Eastern Time for another installment of Dare to Win. Peace. You are the best.